You heard the topic from me already, right? You know my hair there. Okay. And what I'd like to do with this topic, I find that bitachon is one of these topics that the more you're involved in it, the more it helps you. And at stages of life, all stages of life basically, we all need bitachon. And what I've been doing recently, and this is all new material in bitachon, is really just trying to develop a barometer for measuring bitachon and being able to use it for different life circumstances. So I'll explain what I mean. The Chazon Ish says in Umani Bitachon that one of the issues with bitachon is that we talk about bitachon. He says we chirp about bitachon. And then when we get to a real life circumstance, all of a sudden we're like, whoa, okay, you know, am I living up to what I thought, the level that I thought I was on? So people often don't have well integrated bitachon. And also it's very hard to evaluate where you're holding with bitachon until you're really challenged by something. And hello. And you don't want to wait till you're challenged to figure out your bitachon. So what I tried to do is I'm trying to work on this, and this is kind of pretty fresh off the press. I just started doing this recently. It's like developing like a barometer, a five-scale barometer for bitachon, where you can measure the level of integration you have in bitachon, and then you can apply it to different areas. Now, I want to say about the different areas, you know, similar to midos, where like you ask somebody for midos, and there's like certain midos that everybody talks about, ka, simcha, chesed, and then people start getting stuck eventually. Like, what are areas that require bitachon? So people say health, parnasa, shidduchim, world peace, and then they start getting stuck. And what I started noticing when I started doing this research is that there's so many interesting small categories where you need to apply bitachon that, you know, once you start thinking about it, it's everywhere. Okay, so first let's make our five-point barometer for bitachon, and then we'll try to apply it to different situations. Okay, the very first distinction is going to be based on the Chazon Ish, Emunah Bitachon. He describes what is Emunah and what's Bitachon, because we tend to use the terms interchangeably, but they really mean two different things. The Chazon Ish says Emunah is what you know about how Hashem interacts with your life in that particular area. Bitachon is how much you actually believe it and how much it filters down to your world. So the Chazon Ish says that l'chor, a person can have a high level of emunah and a very low level of bitachon. I can rattle off the 13 principles and I know all about whatever, but am I really living by it? So, in our barometer, emunah will be, is there something that the Torah or Chazal teach me about Hashem's interaction with the world in this topic? And I'm going to just bring as an example, it's dafka, not the one that we're going to elaborate on, but let's say finances, parnasa. So the emunah would be, mizonasav sh'adam ptsuvim, the Gemara says, that that people's money is allotted from Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. Okay, good. So I know that Hashem allots finances. That's emunah. Bitachon is, do I feel that way? Do I really feel that Hashem controls parnasa, or do I just know it and not feel it? Stage three will be in the world of actions. Do I make decisions based on that integration of the fact that Hashem controls parnasa? Now, what would be an example of that? Sometimes you get a job offer, which is very, very lucrative and great for your resume, but it will compromise a certain principle that you have in a way that if you say no to that job, you are not only showing that you have a value that you're not willing to compromise, but you also are saying, I believe that Hashem controls parnasa. Because if I didn't believe it, then wow, how could I give up something that's so good and so lucrative and so good for my resume? If I'm willing to say no, it means that I really believe that Hashem controls parnasa. I don't know if I ever said this to you when you were in Mechala, but I was once talking to a woman who lives in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, overlooking Central Park. And she was talking to me, and all of a sudden she stops the conversation and she says, I have to tell you something that you have to tell your students. And she says to me, I'm looking out the window right now and I want to tell you what I see. So there's a boy, a young man, he's married. I know him. He just got back from Israel. He was learning in the mirror, living in Arzeh, whatever it was. And he's walking in Central Park with his black and white.
And he's walking next to a girl who doesn't look Jewish, who's wearing a tank top and shorts and sweatbands, and they're jogging together. And she says, I know exactly what this is. She says, in his firm, where he's now working, and he's trying to get himself into this, like, you know, corporate world, she says, there's a health challenge where you're partnered with somebody who you're supposed to work on health together. So he has to jog with this girl. He's married. He's right off of Israel. And here he is jogging in Central Park with this girl with, you know, a tank top and shorts. Now, I'm not saying whether he should not agree to work for that corporation or not. That's a question for his local Orthodox rabbi, not for me. But if he were to decide that this is compromising his standards, and somebody would say, are you crazy? Like, you have to work yourself up in the corporation? You have to, you know. If he were to decide to say no to such a job, it would be an integration not just of tzniut or moral standards, but also of mizon social demtsuvim. I set up, I make my proactive decisions with the realization that it controls parnasa. A little less dramatic, but if I, as a mother, have to figure out how much effort I'm putting into parnasa, and I get a job offer, which is very lucrative and very good for my reputation, but it will require me to never see my children, and I say, you know what? I don't really think I want to do that. That will be a reflection of the fact that since Hashem controls parnasa, I don't believe that I have to say yes to everything that compromises my standards. Now, again, we have to be able to measure where to compromise what. But actions are a level of integration. Not only do I know that Hashem controls parnasa, not only do I believe it, but I make my proactive choices based on that reality. Now, level four in our barometer is going to be reactions. Reactions are a higher level of integration. Why? Because they catch you off guard. Actions is when you proactively say, this is my red line on this topic, whatever it is. Reactions is, okay, so something very expensive just got lost or broke, and I'm really upset about it, and I'll remind you of something that we said in Mechala many times, that your primary response is not when your Bechira starts. The fact that you might be upset by a big loss has more to do with your homer, your attitudes that you've learned towards money, whatever it would be. Your Bechira starts with your secondary response. So really, when we say reactions, we mean your secondary reactions. And by the way, girls, this is a very important point. Many of us measure our bitachon based on our primary responses. If I find myself getting nervous or anxious or sad or jealous or worried or angry, I'm like, oh, where's my bitachon? The bottom line is that your primary response is the trigger, and bitachon is only a secondary response to the primary trigger. The Chazon Ish says, bitachon is, in a difficult time, bitachon comes lirapoto, lehachlimo, ulenahalo. Bitachon comes to heal a person, lirapoto, lehachlimo, to rehabilitate him, ulenahalo, to direct him. The Chazon Ish is basically implying that something has to be healed. If everything's good, then there's nothing to heal. So bitachon, therefore, is the way I use my emunah filtered down to help me get back on board when I'm feeling anxious or worried. I think I probably said this to you before, but the great proof of this, and maybe the all-time best proof of this, is the mizmor that we dafka say when we're having a hard time. Kuf chaf aleph, we say mizmor l'david esay nai, shir mal l'david esay nai el harim, me'ayin yavo ezri. I look up to Shemayim, me'ayin yavo ezri, where is my help coming from? And then the next pasuk, Ezri mi'im Hashem, Oseh Shemayim Baretz. Shemal Oseh Sanai, not Adavit, Shemal Oseh Sanai, and Arim. Now, the obvious question, David HaMelech had to say, Me'ayin Yavo Ezri, where's my help coming from? Couldn't David HaMelech just say, Shemal Oseh Sanai, and Arim, Ezri mi'im Hashem? Why do you have to say, Me'ayin Yavo Ezri? Those words, Me'ayin Yavo Ezri, are there to validate all primary responses. Worry, anxiety. Even David HaMelech said, uh-oh, who's going to help me? By the next pasuk, he was already using bitachon to answer his question, Ezri mi'im Hashem. So therefore, if David HaMelech had some worry sometimes, we're allowed to have our worries as well. But bitachon comes to help me once I've already been triggered. which is why there are different areas where we're not going to have to use bitachon. If you're easygoing about money, whether you have it or you don't have it, or you just you happen to be easygoing, that's not the issue. The issue is in areas where I am triggered, I need to use bitachon to calm myself down. And I want to go through a few different areas because everybody has different areas where they're triggered. But my biggest chiddush for this topic is stage 5 in the barometer for integration of bitachon. We already said cognition, belief, action, reaction. And now number 5. There is a very interesting idea written in the Sefer called Migdal Oz, which was written by the Chassid Yavetz of Yaakov Emden. So he writes a very beautiful piece where he talks about how bitachon is here to help you in this world. You know, bitachon is one of these things that you don't have to wait till the next world to get the payoff. The schar bitachon is in this world when you're not so worried, the quality of your life. So it says here, to'el ha-bitachon ba'olam, mehem minuchat ha-lev min ha-da'agot ha-olamiyot. When you have bitachon, you have the minucha of your heart from the this-worldly worries. Very interesting. But hashalva minidnud hanefesh b'tzara, the tranquility from nidnud hanefesh. Linadnez, a nadneda means like a seesaw, swing, maybe it's a swing and not a seesaw. No, I think it's a seesaw. Anyway, it's the vacillations, the fluctuations. Nidnud hanefesh b'tzara. You're very worried about something, and you're in a really bad mood about it. Then the next day something happens which seems to imply that it's really improving and you're all of a sudden like in a great mood. And then the next day the situation takes a step back and you're worried again. This is nidnud hanefesh v'tza'ara. Bitachon gives you shalva from this nidnud. And then the Chassid Yavetz has 3 words that I got very excited about when I saw it. He says, lachsoch ta'avoteha hagufaniot. That bitachon saves you, lachsoch, ta'avoteh, taiva, physical temptation, hagufaniot. Now, I had a very feminine interpretation of this. The worst thing to do when you're really excited about an idea is show it to a husband who knows how to learn. And he says, oh, that was cute. You know, I don't think it's pshat at what Rav Yaakov Emden meant, but it's cute. So he said, I could teach it anyway, even though it's cute. Lachsoch ta'avoteh gufaniyot. I was thinking, what do we do when we're very worried or we're very pained? We usually have some kind of escape behavior where we get into some kind of compulsive thing. Not everybody does this, but some people will run for chocolate and some people will go shopping and rack up a bill and some people will spend too much time on the internet. If taiva means compulsion. When you look at the way Chazal talk about taiva, taiva is when I go for something without a thought-out approach, and a little bit of it makes me want a little bit more, and a little more, and a little more, and now I have a new problem on my hand. Not only did I not solve the old problem, but I have a new problem. There's all kinds of taiva. There's the classic ones, but criticizing is also taiva, and talking on the phone all day is also taiva, and overworking or excessive cleaning or obsessive exercising, whatever we do when we're so nervous, wherever we go to is a reflection of our anxiety or our sadness. So I was thinking that maybe Rav Yaakov Emden is saying that one of the beauties of bitachon in this world is lachsoch ta'avoteh gufaniyot. It saves you from the compulsive behaviors. Because as you internalize bitachon on a deeper level, you might find yourself dealing with stress in a different way. And you might say, last time I went through this, I gained 5 pounds. Or I lost 5 pounds, by the way, controlling food in the other direction is also taiva. Or I racked up a bill, or whatever I did. Wow, look at me. I've worked on myself, and now I didn't have to go to those escape behaviors as much. So that's lachsoch ta'avoteh gufaniyot. So if we go to our 5-point barometer of measuring integration of bitachon, the 5th and deepest level, and this is not easy, these take a while to work on, would be to find a change in the way I compulsively respond to pressure and stress or sadness. Okay, now that we have the 5 points, and really it's not about beating yourself up when you catch yourself somewhere. It's about being mindful of, okay, here's where I still need to work. I know that there's an issue here, and I need to work on integrating. In fact, I was even thinking maybe it's like achrei pulot nimshachololot. That's even like your reaction to something. And you say, if I were to be on a higher level of bitachon, how would I have expected myself to act? How would I like to react? What would it look like if I had higher levels of bitachon? And then you can decide to go after the actions. Maybe to talk in a calm voice, even though you're not feeling so calm. Or maybe not to do something compulsive. But it's because I know that I'm not there yet, and that's okay. Bitachon is a lifelong process. But right now, I would like to be aware of the fact that I'm catching myself at a place where I need to work on bitachon. And let's see if I can at least simulate through external behavior the way I would like to be. Okay. Now, what I want to do right now is to dafka move it away from money, because that's, for some people, not the issue, and move into a few different categories of where I need bitachon. So I'd like to say that in the general world, there's two big avodah zarahs that people have. Money is one of them, and convenience is the other. People whose avodah zarah is convenience are willing to spend a lot of money on conveniences. People whose avodah zarah is money are willing to inconvenience themselves greatly to save a little bit of money. They'll, you know, go to another city to buy cornflakes cheaper, but they spent more money traveling than what they actually saved on the cornflakes. People have pretty entrenched patterns with these things. And I would say it's Hashem's joke on you when the two different types marry each other. It's a lot of fun. A lot of things to work out. So, therefore, we need a bitachon reframe, not just for money, but for convenience. Because convenience causes a lot of Westerners a lot of stress, which means that we need bitachon about convenience to calm me down from my stress about inconvenience. And I think most people have some issue around inconvenience. It's just that depending on where their tolerance threshold is, it might take more to make them feel stressed. Some people are stressed by small things, some people are stressed by big things. So what is the Torah's answer when we ask the question, is Hashem involved in inconveniences? So here we have a very beautiful source which teaches us something about this. And this is on the Emunah level, point one, my Sechel. The Pasuk in Tehillim Tzadik Dalet, the Pasuk says, Ashrei hageber asher tiasrenu ka umitorasecha tilamdeinu. Blessed is the person that Hashem gives him Yisurim and teaches him from his Torah. So, first of all, the word Yisurim. I was just thinking about this recently. Yisurim is a very interesting word in the Torah. Yisurim is everything from the most tragic, difficult, heart-wrenching circumstances, all the way down to the most basic inconveniences are called Yisurim. The Gemara says that, the Gemara gives four examples of Yisurim. One of them we always talk about. Where you put your hands in your pocket and you take out the wrong amount of change, it's called Yisurim. The other three in that Gemara are similar. You go to pour yourself a cup of hot water and cold water comes out. You put on your shirt backwards and you need to take it off and put it on again. You have a piece of clothing sewn for you and it doesn't fit properly. That one could really be annoying. But they're all, you would never call them big life challenges. You would call them inconveniences. So why does the Torah call these things Yisurim? So I was thinking two things. One is that maybe the Torah is trying to tell you that Hashem loves you so much that you really should have a perfect life. And even the minor inconveniences are Yisurim because they're not stum, they're not random, they happen for a reason, I'm supposed to grow through them. But on a more deep level, I think that that Gemara is really validating the fact that people have different tolerance thresholds for inconvenience. Because for some people, putting their hands in the pocket and coming out with the wrong money is going to be annoying. And for others, totally not. So basically, you're being asked not to judge people Some people are very easygoing, and they won't consider a lot of things to be inconvenience. Some people are more high-strung, and little things bother them. But the Torah is saying, that's your chomer. And different people will call different things yisur. So let's read back the pasuk. Ashrei hagever she'tiasrenu ka. Blessed is the person who Hashem inconveniences him, if you want to put it that way. U'metorasecha tilamdeinu, and teaches him from his Torah. So I want to read to you, and this is the reframe for inconvenience. And not the reframe, it's like the, it's the cognitive anchor for bitachon and inconvenience. This is coming from the Alkut Shemoni on the Pasuk in Tehillim that we just read. Amar Rav Bizna. Ein adam ba'olam lelo yisurin. There's nobody in the world who doesn't have yisurin. Choshesh b'sheino eino yachol lishon. Someone has a toothache, he can't sleep well. Be'eino eino yachol lishon. If his eye hurts, he can't sleep well. Yageh b'torah eino yoshen. Somebody who stays up learning late at night is also not sleeping the whole hours. Ze'er v'ze'er. This one is up and that one is up. Lev Mintzberg, who wrote a sefer, a very beautiful series for those of you who want to, you know, learn Bitachon more in Omek. There's a series called Ben Melech, and he has a sefer called Bitachon. One volume is called Bitachon, and he says you learn something very, very important from this Yalkut Shemoni. What do you learn? Two very important things. One is that inconveniences are katzer from Shemayim. Just like money is designated and allotted from Shemayim, so is inconvenience. Because look at the Medrash. The Yalkut says that there's three people who lose sleep at night. The constant is that they had to lose a certain amount of sleep. The variable is why do they lose the sleep? Toothache, eyeache, learning Torah, friend talking very loud on the phone, some honking of a car outside. Million possibilities of what will wake you up at night and ruin your sleep. So the Torah is telling you, zeher v'zeher, meaning you cannot circumvent the inconvenience, but it can come through different ways. I have found this to be very helpful, because sometimes, especially us Westerners who are used to convenience, when something takes much longer than expected, or something really didn't turn out to be the way it was supposed to be, very often you're thinking, but this was supposed to be easy. I was supposed to be home by now. What's this traffic? What's going on here? So I started thinking about an inconvenience pie, and I'm cutting a piece out of my inconvenience pie. Since inconvenience is cut from Shemayim anyway, couldn't circumvent it, I'm just cutting out a piece. There's less to go around. I find this comforting. But then we get to the second point in the Yalkut that I think is very important. The Yalkut is telling you that since inconvenience is katzer from Shemayim anyway, it's better if it comes through a mitzvah. And that's why it says, Ashrei hagever asher tiasrenu ka, u'metorasecha tilamdeinu. If the reason why you're losing sleep is because you're learning Torah, that's better than losing sleep from a toothache. Now, why is it better to lose? Sometimes, you know, a parent asks you to do something and it's really inconvenient and you kind of like are really frustrated about it. So sometimes we say, oh, if my mother wouldn't have asked me to do this, I would have had a much easier day. Or sometimes it's checking something for bugs and saying, oh, if I didn't have to check this, I'd be out of the kitchen already. Or sometimes it's cooking for Shabbos or sneos or halachos that are not always so easy for us. And sometimes our voice says, oh, if I didn't have to do this, life would be so much easier. So according to the Yalkut, you have to switch the cause and the effect. The inconvenience was katzer from Shemayim anyway. But if already I have to be inconvenienced, it's better that I should be inconvenienced through a mitzvah than through something else. You know, this explains to me, sometimes I deal with people who are not religious and have a lot less chiyuvim in their lives than I do. But I'm yet to meet a woman in any part of the world who says that life is so convenient and there are no stresses. You could have 5 maids and 6 butlers and not have to keep halacha because you don't know anything about halacha, and you still feel that life is stressful. Because inconvenience is cut from Shemayim. It cannot be circumvented. Therefore, it's better to experience inconvenience through a mitzvah. Now, why? Why is it better? So I think maybe we did this once in Michala, that the Gemara says, Echad b'tzar shaveh l'mea shelo b'tzar. One mitzvah done with inconvenience is worth 100 times more than a mitzvah done without inconvenience. So it also validates the fact that some of us have a harder time with certain mitzvahs than others. But if I have a hard time, Hashem also pays me back 100 times more. And most of us are not inconvenienced 100 times more than our friends, but you get 100 times more time. Okay. So, therefore, that's what adds the value to the fact that the inconvenience is coming through a mitzvah. Sure.
So, based on that, should we try to pursue the things that are hard?
Okay. That's a very complicated question. And in this one area, I will say, when I said the levels of integration, I said that really it's about emunah, it's about cognition, and then it's about bitachon. Then it's about actions, reactions, and compulsions. That's the five standards. And usually actions is a lower level of integration than reactions, because reactions catch you off guard. With this particular topic, I would say that reactions come before actions. And I'll explain why. Reactions are, I'm already in a situation. I'm schlepping this thing for my mother. I didn't get a chance to do what I wanted to do. I'm rolling my eyes. And I'm thinking, Asher geber she'tesun akam etorasach atzol din. Since inconvenience cannot be circumvented anyway, better let it come through a mitzvah. That's a reaction. But now you're talking about, do I elect myself to do mitzvahs that are inconvenienced, that are inconveniences, with the realization that since I can't circumvent inconvenience anyway, I might as well do this mitzvah. This is tricky. Because sometimes we try to direct traffic in Shemayim and say, Hashem, I'll go to the store 1,000 times for my mother, just don't give me any other you serve. Can't really control Hashem in that way. So where do you know if you're at a level where you can proactively decide to take on a mitzvah that's inconvenient? And by the way, this is very relevant to our lives. There's all kinds of things that you have to do, and then there are things that you don't have to do, but they're mitzvahs. When you hear, you know, there's an old lady who needs people to sleep over, and do you mind, you know, does anybody want to volunteer? And you're thinking, okay, this will really inconvenience me. I have a big task. Should I do it or not? And this is a little bit difficult. So I want to explain in the following ways. There are people who are living on the level that really their actions are affected by the Zalkut Shimon. They will take on difficult mitzvot with the realization that it is inconvenient. And for them, it is the level that they're on. I once heard a beautiful, just recently, somebody was talking to me and was saying, look, there's a difference between a jump and a stretch. A jump is when you say yes to something and you temporarily go up, but the nature of jumps is that you can't sustain, you can't stay on the place where you are, so you crash down, and then it's, oh, what was I thinking when I took this on? And we've all been there. Said yes to a favor and then muttered your way through the favor as it was totally more difficult than you would have expected, or, you know, that's called a jump. I thought I was on this level and now I realize that I just took off more than I can handle. A stretch is different than a jump. A stretch is that this is like, yes, bigger than me, but stretches are supposed to make you feel good. And when you can stretch and take on something and then later say, wow, I'm really happy that I did that. I'll even go so far, Dvar, as to answer your question that, you know, I notice that sometimes there's a very subtle reality in certain cultures that people perpetuate this self-care mission of, you have a lot on your plate, don't take on anything extra. You can't afford to stretch. Don't say yes to that mitzvah. You have enough to do. You're going to regret it. And then there are even sometimes cultures. When I speak about cultures, I mean even groups of friends where, like, people are willing to do bigger things in life. And the bottom line is that it has to be very individual consideration. We should not be so affected by the self-care culture of don't take on anything extra. Everybody has so much on their plate that nobody's doing anything for somebody else's empty plate because I have too much on my plate. And then we have people who sometimes do crazy things that are not worth it and are not even responsible. So I apologize if I ever told this story in any context, but this was a very major source of inspiration for me on this topic, about sometimes you need to expose yourself to people who are living with a very high level of integration of this Siyata of Shimon. And they literally elect themselves for difficult mitzvot, but for them, it works. And the message for me then is to figure out where do I need to stretch, maybe not the same way as them. So the preface of this story is that I have these very funny cousins who make Hanukkah parties for the family. And one year, their theme for this party was Tzedekah's Candid Camera. Did I tell the story in the whole hour? Is it sounding familiar? No? Not sounding familiar? Tzedekah's Candid Camera was a very funny thing that they did. They called up different family members and pretended to be heads of chesed organizations. Pretended. I did tell this fellow somewhere. I think we did the inconvenience by in your group. I am sorry, it's a repeat because I didn't do it in this general class. Okay, I'll try to move on to another one soon. But anyway, just to tell the story very quickly, they recorded different family members by asking them to do a mitzvah, a chesed, and recording their responses. Like, hi, I'm running a chesed event tonight, and I'm not feeling good, and somebody said that you're the person I could ask. So can you pick up the speaker, pick up the prizes, open the hall, set up the sound system, you know, collect the prizes, bring the speaker home, bring me the money, like stranger calling and asking for this. So they did all this recording of people's responses when you ask them for a favor. So it's very funny to see how people respond. So one of the phone calls was somebody said, you know, I'm calling from an orphanage and we have a very lovely 7-year-old boy who needs a foster home. And we did a lot of research, thousands of families of Yerushalayim were screened. And it comes up, you're elected. You're the best family for this boy, so will you take him in? And the person who was called said, wow, thank you so much, I'm so honored, I've discussed with my husband. To which the interviewer says, well, when's your husband coming home? And she says, no, that's too late. He's sitting on the suitcases, he has to know where he's going. So all these kind of funny types of, you know, putting people on the spot to do a mitzvah. Anyway, fast forward, and I'll tell the story because a few people here recognize this topic, and we have a few more levels of this 5-point bitachon. Okay, so I'll just say quickly that my daughter had a girl in her class who came from a very poor background and also had lost her father under tragic circumstances. And the parents in the class had raised money for her to have like a big sister, like a girl come take her out every day and buy her things and take care of her. At some point, I became aware of the fact that the girl, the teenager, got married, and there was nobody else taking over to take care of this girl. Her mother was under tremendous stress, and she really needed somebody to come take her out of the house. The house was a very unhappy place to be. So when I asked the teacher to recommend a new girl, a new high school girl, the teacher said to me, I don't have any high school girls to recommend, but I'm going to give you two phone numbers, Gveret Schwartz and Gveret Cohen, not their names. And I said to her, Gveret, like a busy woman with a family is going to take care of this girl? She says, you'll see. Called the person, I don't know who I'm calling. I said, hi, I'm calling because I'm trying to arrange somebody to take care of a girl who really has in a very stressful situation, no money, and she lost her parents, and she really needs like a home to go to or a place to be. 20 seconds into the conversation, I had not identified myself, and I didn't identify the girl. The woman on the other end says to me, so do you want her to move in tomorrow? And I remember thinking like, whoa. If you don't know me, and you're offering to just foster a girl forever, like tomorrow she can move in. So I said to the woman, I said, wow, that's a very big decision. Maybe you want to like, you know, think about it, you know, sleep on it a little bit before you make such a big decision. She says to me, and this is where I really learned my hashkafa about this. She says to me, Gveret, do you really think that my life will be any more convenient if I don't take in a poor girl who needs a home? And things don't break, and kids don't fight, and messes don't happen. And it was like a rhetorical question that was like kind of floating in the air. I'm like, wow. Like some people are literally living by, like, this is kind of causing me inconvenience. And I hear her kids in the background. She has like a lively house, probably a very small Yerushalayim apartment. And she finally says to me, oh, I just have to ask you one question. I think, oh, Baruch Hashem, she has some criteria. And I said, oh, money, I forgot to tell her. We have money collected for this. I said, oh, I guess she's low. No, it's not kesef. She has no about a zar called convenience, and she has no about a zar called kesef. She said, I just need to meet the girl privately. to see if the chemistry between her and my children will be good. And if it's good, she can move in tomorrow. And if it's not good, I'll use the interview as an opportunity to find her another home. We end the conversation. She doesn't know my name. She doesn't know the girl's name. And she's adopting this girl as of tomorrow. Fostering, not adopting. When I hung up, I said, there are people in the world who are like this. But the message for me is not to adopt a child without asking my husband first. That wasn't the message. But if I roll my eyes at different mitzvahs that are hard, this is where I have to work on integrating this idea. But the answer, Dvorah, is that sometimes we actually elect for something. You can elect in a manipulative way. Hashem, okay, I'll just take on all this mitzvahs. But sometimes you're at a parshas drachim where there's a stretch. And the thing that's stopping, that's the obstacle between you and the stretch is convenience. And not because it's not good for me and I might fall apart. There's a lot of considerations which would be very justified to say no to something. And we always say that as a Jewish woman, you have to think, achash bon ma. If I'm going to fall apart emotionally from this, or my parents will be very upset at me, or something will be, you have a lot of reasons to say no. But sometimes the only obstacle is convenience, and really you can stretch. If you don't worship convenience, you can stretch. So it's for every person to measure. Okay, let's go on to a different application, because the convenience part is familiar to some of you. This one I like even more than the convenience pie. And this is bitachon in cognitive processes. Let me explain what I mean. The sugya of Yosef and the Sar HaMashkim is a very, very well spoken out sugya where you learn a lot of principles of bitachon and ishtablos. But basically, we all know the basic story. Yosef gets the Sar HaMashkim out of jail. And what does he do? He just says, can you please help me, return the favor, remember me, remind Paro about me. The Chazal teach us that this was a problem. Because he said, he ims the hartani itcha, which is kareni al Paro, his kartani al Paro, he mentions the heart twice, in Vayeshev Mem, Pasuk Yudalid. Chazal say that unfortunately his father should spend 2 extra years in jail because of the 2 times that he asked the Saranashka to remember him. The end of Parshas Vayeshev, and this becomes very practical for your lives, girls, it's a pasuk. V'lo zachar sar hamashkim et Yosef v'yishkachehu. Seems like a double lashon. Sar hamashkim didn't remember him and he forgot him. And Parshas Vayeshev ends with the words v'yishkachehu. The Aruch Chaim says v'yishkachehu. Why the double lashon? Ulay yirmoz ba'amro v'yishkachehu azeh derech v'yishkachehu aval kadosh baruch hu lo shachachah. Hashem doesn't forget. Human beings forget. But Hashem never forgets. And then we have a medrash. Morty, can I just ask you, what did we say that we're ending and starting the podcast? Perfect. Perfect. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for the organizing. Okay. This is a very interesting medrash. Medrash HaGadol. Amar Rav Berchia. Al tikre v'yishkachehu, ela v'yishakchehu. The Yishkacheu means he forgot him. Sar Mashkim forgot Yosef. The Yishakcheu means he was caused to forget Yosef. He feel. Hashem made him forget Yosef. What we learn from this Medrash is that people's forgetfulness and their memory is in the hands of Hashem. If Hashem needs you to struggle, then a very responsible person will uncharacteristically forget the thing that they were supposed to do for you. And if Hashem needs you to do something easy, to have it easy, some very flaky person, sorry to say it that way, will remember you. Because all cognitive processes go through Hashem. And the reason why I bring this up is that the topic of people's memory and forgetfulness is something which causes us a nice amount of stress, depending on the stage of life that you're in. So in my stage of life, if I go away for a week and I ask the last person leaving the house to shut off the air conditioning, and I get back a week later, it's been blasting all week. So that forgetfulness is a source of stress. The person who forgets or loses your key and you're locked out of your apartment. The phone number that you remember or not, one digit off, then you mess yourself up because you keep on trying to reach this person. reminding someone to bring the salad, and they forget. And here I like to say that there's a very big action. We're talking about integration. I know that Hashem controls memory. I believe it, and my actions. You know, some of us, were you ever on either side of this, where there's an event being planned, and you get an email around the month in advance, thank you so much for committing and agreeing to bring a salad to the event. And then a week later, just reminding you, the salad on November 17th. And then a week before, the salad. A day before, the salad. An hour before, the salad. And then you know what? You forget the salad on your table. That is not a coincidence. You know why? Because it's something called learned forgetfulness. If you know that somebody else will take responsibility for reminding you, you very often don't own the thing that you have to remember, because somebody else is going to remind you. Memory is something that you have to do shtadlus for. And if somebody else is going to do the shtadlus for you, you know, we actually sometimes cause people to forget by reminding them so much. So in the world of actions, I know Hashem controls these cognitive processes. I believe it. And therefore, what's a normal amount of shtadlus in reminding somebody? Since I don't control this anyway, is one reminder enough? Maybe two? Or maybe not 10. The person who forgets your birthday, when you're kind of sensitive about that. The application that gets forgotten on the desk, even though you really applied on time and spent a lot of time on the application. The shadchan who forgets you until they suddenly remember you. Or maybe they weren't supposed to remember you in the first place. The teacher who forgets to call on your vulnerable kid. The girl who forgets to invite the socially insecure girl to the birthday party. The forgotten groceries that spoil and the stains that set in. I'll give you two interesting ones. I had a woman, a Michala Pitt mother, called me freaking out right by her daughter's wedding that her daughter had a chuppas nida, which happens sometimes. But the reason why it happened is because the daughter forgot to take the medication that was supposed to regulate her cycle. So the mother is, I thought that this kala would not make it alive to her wedding. I literally thought, like, there's going to be no alive kala here. The pictures, the this, the Rosh Hashanah, like, how it affected everything. I didn't even hear what the girl thought about it. But the point is, sometimes things happen. But when somebody forgets to do something that they're supposed to do, it just infuriates us sometimes. And bitachon means that the person might be, have to be accountable for what they've done. But when you say their forgetfulness ruined the events, the answer is that I was supposed to be challenged here, and that's why they forgot. This doesn't take away the hishtalas of sometimes teaching people, calling them to task. I might have to teach a child who loses my credit card all the time to remember. But when I say you ruined my day because you forgot the card, that's not true. The sovev and the mesovav, the Chazon Ish says, has to be switched. It's not because the card was forgotten, it ruined my day. It was that I was supposed to be checked today, and that's why you forgot. I have a very dear friend who has a very lovely little boy who was born with certain health issues, and he needed a kidney transplant. And he was recovering from his transplant. And then in a momentary blitz of the memory, a doctor forgot something, gave him the wrong medication. Not only did his kidney fail, but he also needed a liver transplant after that. And he's still struggling with all the health issues that came as a result of the 1 second forgetfulness. When I see the bitachon that my friend has, she says she's not into the suing and the malpractice. She herself is a doctor. She says, I just pray that it never happens to me, that my forgetfulness has such a, I should momentarily forget something. It could happen to anybody. And she feels terrible for somebody whose 1 second forgetfulness affected her child's life. But in her mind, her child was supposed to struggle. And this happens to be the unfortunate shaliach for the struggle, and not vice versa. So there's a lot to think about when we think about people. And I think that in the world of, again, you know, in the world of dating, it's people who remember you and set you up. In marriage, it's the annoying things that your husband forgets. There's always places where this causes us a lot of stress. We have to remember that Vishakhehu, Hashem controls Shechacha, and he controls cognitive processes. Not that the Shalchan forgot, it's that they weren't supposed to remember. If they don't have the guy he was supposed to marry, they weren't supposed to remember. And they might have thought you were an amazing girl, but they're going to be distracted and not set you up if they don't have the... if your Ploni is not on their list of people who they know, they will not remember you, even if they should. And it's important for us to remember this. Okay, we'll wind down with just a reframe on bitachon in shidduchim and general in hishtalos in the stage of life that you're at. Of course, we always say that Elokim Moshiv Yechidim Besa, I always say that's the mantra of the bitachon in relationships, that Hashem decides who you're going to marry, and Hashem plops the person into your life and into your home. I won't go deeply into this one. There's a lot to say about it. But I'll say one point about it. At the end of the pasuk, we've spoken about this in Mechala. Motzi asirim bekoshrot. He takes out prisoners with koshrot. Kaf, vav, shin, resh, vav, tav. That word does not appear in Tanakh, to the best of my knowledge. And Chazal therefore give two possible interpretations of what it means. Bekoshrot. Elokim moshiv v'chid besa. Hashem decides who you're going to marry and when you're going to get married. Where's your bechira? Bekoshrot is a compound word, bechi b'shirot, crying or singing. The bechira that's in your point is whether to go through a state of life being sad or trying to fill yourself with shira to do good things as you prepare yourself and you believe that Hashem will send you the right person at the right time. But the other word, bekoshrot, Chazal say in Medrash Rabbah Samach, in Brish Rabbah Samachet, that the word kaf, the letter kaf, can be changed to kof, bikoshrot. Bikoshrot here, like shor, means handcuffed. Elokim moshiv yechidim besa, motzi asirim bikoshrot. He takes out prisoners with handcuffs. I recently refined this mashal a little bit. If I were to show you a picture of somebody walking, and you only saw them from the legs down, and they're walking, and I say to you, are they free to choose where they're going? You'd be like, yeah, they're walking. I zoom up the picture, and you see that the person is handcuffed, and he's wearing a black and white striped outfit. And then I say, is this person free to choose where he's walking? And the bottom line is his legs are free, but it's clear that he's being led. The mashal here is that when you make dating decisions, I can say, are you free to choose who to marry? On some level, yeah, I broke up with this one, I went out with this one, I didn't like him, I liked him, this one dumped me, I dumped him. Whatever your narrative is. But then when you zoom up the picture, motzi asirim bekoshrot, on some level you're free like that prisoner is free to walk. But on the bigger level, attraction, chemistry, who says yes to you, who misunderstood you or broke up with you, it's all Hashem's way of motzi asirim bekoshrot. It's not the most romantic pasuk in the Torah, but it's very calming. You could think the guy's amazing, but if he's not your bashar, he's not going to like you. And you're going to think, maybe I didn't say the right thing, maybe I made the wrong impression, maybe I didn't wear the right outfit. None of it. Hashem is directing traffic here. And yes, I'm making decisions, but really he's controlling. And here it leads me to my last point. We have to wind down. It's very interesting, how much hishtalos are you supposed to make? Shidduchim, parnasa, anything. So the Maharil Diskin says that there's really, the sources are confusing. There's a source in Dvarim, I think it's Rav Tesbav, where we say, the pasuk says, Ubrachticha b'chol asher ta'aseh. Dvarim Tesbav, pasuk Yudches. Ubrachticha b'chol asher ta'aseh seems to imply a person should be doing hishtalos, and Hashem will put his bracha on the person's ishtadlus. Then we have the pasuk in Tehillim that says, Hashlech al Hashem yahavcha, v'hu yichal kalecha. Throw your stuff onto Hashem and he'll take care of it. Seems to imply no ishtadlus. So what's really the level of ishtadlus? So the Maharil Diskin says that there's a third pasuk, which is really the Shvil HaZahav, of Hishtadlus. pasuk says, "Gol al Hashem drachecha." It says Tehillim Lamed Zayin pasuk Hey. Pasuk says, "Gol Hashem drachecha, ubetachla v'hu ya'aseh." Gol is Moshon legalgel, to roll. I said to myself, the Maharil Diskin did not live in the time of bowling. But sometimes I take my little kids bowling, and I said, this is such a good mashal for this. A little child who's not very skilled in bowling, he like throws the ball, like pushes the ball down the lane. It wasn't a very good throw. But until it actually rolls, you have no idea, because sometimes it goes immediately into the gutter, and sometimes there's a strike that comes out of those rolls. If you've ever got bowling with a little child, like the ball is like slow, slow. It centers just before it gets the pins, and then it's a strike. Gol Hashem Drachecha, you have to get the ball rolling. Ubetach alav, v'hu yaseh. After you get the ball rolling, you have to realize that he's going to decide the outcome of the rolling of your ball. The Maharil Diskin did not live in the tkufa of bowling, but his mashal is a person who's trying to get down the mountain and has a very heavy barrel, which also has to get down the mountain. He says, you have two choices. You can carry that barrel down the mountain, and it's very heavy. Or you can roll the barrel down the mountain and walk down without it. He says, you can decide. You want to call 1,000 shadchanim? Go ahead. You want to work 18 hours a day? Go ahead. You're carrying the barrel. Or you can roll the barrel. Gol Hashem drachecha. Do a fair amount to get the ball rolling, to leave room for Siyata Dishmaya. But Hashem controls. Yagata umatzata time in the Mishnah says. The Mishnah should say Yagata, you tried. Umatzata yumatzliach. It should say Yagata ubitzlachte. Yagata vihisachte. It says Yagata umatzata, but Siyah is a find. You do your Yagia, but Basav Hashem is going to give you a find, which is not directly related to how much you tried. And that's why the Mishnah says, Yagatu Matam. So we always have to keep in mind, I'm rolling the ball. I'm contributing, but he's controlling. He knows exactly what he's doing. He manages very well without me. It's etiquette in this world to do some Mishnah. So it's etiquette for a guest to ask the host, is there anything I could do to help? But the guest is not running the Shabbos table and did not cook the food and is not responsible if it came out salty or if it's hot. It's etiquette to say, can I help? It's etiquette to do hishtalos in this world. Hashem is the host. He's in charge. And I'm helping out. Because that's the proper etiquette in this world, is to help out. To contribute. But the same way a guest is not responsible for the food being hot, I don't have to bear this all on me. I'm not responsible for it. Hashem's responsible for it. I'm contributing and I'm not controlling. I feel bad because I have a first meeting with somebody and we're already running a little bit late. So this is the idea to think about for Nishtava. Thank you so much, everybody. So nice to see you.